Professor Gundlach, Lawyers Ethics, December 2nd, 2008, podcast number 9, in Roosevelt 010.
Why didn't they write
Right. And I think most of them are taking it at 10 a.m.
Right, so maybe that's what I'm saying. All I know is I said it sounds to me like that's pushing it, but my language should be fine.
Okay. What's pushing it?
Pushing
it in the sense that it's pretty easy and it gets
Well, I had no idea. I managed through my finals once, and I was like, I had the complex and have spaced out. I had things like seven. Because I got the time in October, my language is with the forms. It will start to stick a lot. And then, it's really
Okay. So it shouldn't be an issue for mine, but I think the other one she's giving is fine. You'll be happy to know that I think I've successfully gotten the admin law to switch the time slot, and so you'll be able to take the class. It appears that there were no people who were registered in both of the classes who wouldn't have created a time slot for anybody else to move it during that class. We're waiting to hear back just from Professor Irving King to make sure that it's okay with him. Any other folks who have been? God, this is completely throwing me out of whack. Leftover Halloween candy, so I'm hoping to get rid of it all by the end of the day. Second of all, I hope everybody show of hands is coming to the Night Owl breakfast tonight. No? Free food? Professors and administrators serving it up for you? You gotta go. I'm gonna be there. Okay. What? So it's 7:30 in the atrium. You can stay around till 7:30. Free food. Did I mention free food? Yeah, so professors, all your favorite professors, they'll be, you know, putting on their aprons and serving out food for you. Did people not go to this last year? I heard that the lines literally wrapped around the building.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
First.
What?
Yeah, first.
That was first year? Oh, they didn't have last year?
Yeah.
Got it. All right. We'll be sure to go. Okay, so I'm going to get through the rest of the material from last week pretty quickly before we move into this week's material. I only got two inquiries, which leads me to believe that everybody feels great, like great experts for the exam. Either that or you just haven't even thought about it yet. So I'm going to assume the latter. And if you have lingering questions, then what I'm going to recommend is that you actually post them on TWEN so everybody gets the benefit of the answer. If you don't post it on TWEN and you instead email me, I will post the answer on TWEN along with the question that was asked, and I won't include your name so that it's not, you know, if you've got any issue with your name being out there. And I'm happy to field questions on TWEN up until the point of the exam, okay? Any other lingering questions about the exam before we get started? Okay. All right. So we left off when we were just about to get into the whole discussion about imputed disqualification and migratory lawyers last time around. And as we began to see in some of the problems that we were looking at, the analysis changes somewhat, especially in some jurisdictions, when the conflict arises out of in relation to migrating lawyers. And as I emphasized and re-emphasized and re-emphasized again, although the majority of jurisdictions out there allow for some sort of screening in certain kinds of circumstances based on migrating lawyers and imputed conflicts, the model rules still have not gotten up to speed with that and are still taking a very conservative approach to this, and they don't allow for screening. We also talked about the irrebuttable presumption under 1.9A, as well as the rebuttable presumption under 1.9B, which we'll get into again in a minute, just as a brief reminder. So two questions tend to arise. You've got the situation where a lawyer is leaving a firm, and the question becomes, does that firm's clients, either current or former, become that leaving lawyer's former clients? And if so, will those conflicts always then be imputed to the new firm? In other words, does a lawyer bring a knapsack of his or her conflicts with him when he goes to the new firm? Okay, so that's one question. Another is, when a lawyer leaves a firm, do the lawyer's clients that he had while at that firm, who are now the lawyer's former clients, continue to conflict out the old firm? So in other words, does the lawyer leave his or her conflicts behind at the old firm even after going to a new firm? And if so, under what circumstances? So you've got the leaving lawyer carrying the baggage of the conflicts and also leaving the conflicts behind. So Scott, give us a quick review of what happened in Cromley before we use that to then help us get into the can we hire the guy problem on page 292.
So Cromley, the high school teacher, brought an action under 42 U.S.C. 1903 against the high school. The complaint basically asserted that the school had retaliated against her because she complained to a state agency about sexual misconduct of a co-worker. She claimed that was protected speech. After 2 years of pretrial litigation, Cromley's attorney, Larry Wiener, accepted a partnership in the Scariano law firm, the same firm representing the defendants. And subsequently, Wiener then withdrew from the lawyer. The district court granted summary judgment to the Board of Education and denied Cromley's motion to disqualify the defendant's attorney. So the court came up with some kind of a factor test. Basically, the first inquiry was whether there was a substantial relationship between the subject matter of the prior and present representations. If yes, then you could ascertain whether the presumption of the shared confidences, you would try to see whether there was a presumption of shared confidences with respect to the prior representation to be rebutted. And if not, to consider whether the presumption of shared confidences had been rebutted with respect to the present representation.
Right. Okay. So just to stop there for a minute. So here, just to distinguish from Analytica, in Analytica, the presumption was irrebuttable because the firm was basically switching sides. Here, you have a lawyer who is going from one firm who is representing the plaintiff to going to another firm that happens to be representing the defendant in the same proceeding. Okay, so this sets up a situation where, according to Cromley, there's actually a rebuttable presumption. And so, as Scott rightfully says, the test is, first of all, you know, is there a substantial relationship? Again, just as under the model rule 1.9. And then is there a presumption of shared confidences from the prior representation, and is that rebutted? And is the presumption of shared confidences in the present representation rebutted? Okay, so that's the test, the Cromley test that's used. Obviously, we've got a substantial, it's the same exact litigation. So that part of the test checked, and we're moving on. So what does the court say about the presumptions?
They said that, what was it? The attorney, Wiener, or the Board of Education, they rebutted the presumption of shared confidences by doing a screening process.
Right.
Basically, once Wiener joined the firm, he was denied access to all the relevant files. He and the other attorneys were warned not to discuss any aspect of the case, otherwise they'd all be subject to discipline. He and Dave Kula, the attorney representing the defendants, agreed that nothing of substantive nature regarding the instant lawsuit would occur until decisions were made and the clients were made aware of them.
And how did the firm get all of this information about all these measures that were taken to protect the confidences? Anybody know? How does this happen? How do you get all this information before the court? Are you raising your hand?
Would there be like a hearing on the matter?
Yep. And then so sometimes you might have a hearing on it, but probably first is with respect to the motion itself, you're going to attach what? Affidavits. Right. So what would happen is the attorneys would fill out these affidavits. There might be one from the managing partner of the firm outlining all the screening measures that are in place. You'll have the one from the lawyer, him or herself, saying, I never worked on this case, don't have any confidences, blah, 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 whatever. So those would be the kinds of affidavits that you would attach. And then you might very well have, if there is a hearing on the motion, you might very well have to then get on the stand and engage in any further inquiry. So here the court really determined, after looking at all of these facts that have been presented, that sufficient screening measures had been implemented. And so this protected any confidences that Wiener had that he may have felt compelled to share with his new law firm. So the idea is you've got this presumption that Wiener, in coming to the new firm, is going to feel so compelled to assist this new firm and in working on this new case that he's not going to be able to help himself, and he's going to spill all of these confidences from the previous case. So that's the presumption that the courts operate under. And what the Cromley Court says is you can overcome that presumption in one of two ways. You can make very clear that you never actually had any confidential information in the first place. That's not really an option because obviously Wiener was the one who was actually representing Cromley in these proceedings. So that wasn't going to be the option. The only other way to do it is to establish that proper screening mechanisms had taken place. And so, again, we had this affidavit and all of the screening measures that were outlined. And in particular, I want you to make sure that you look carefully on page 295, I think it's 295 of the opinion, where they really go through all of the proper screening mechanisms that should take place. Because that's a real model example of what a law firm should do. Okay? So anytime you're going to be thinking about this, if you're in-house ethics counsel, if, you know, whatever reason you're aware of a conflict situation in your firm, then you're going to want to make sure that all of those measures are in place. You're also going to want to be able to truthfully say that those measures were implemented in whatever particular proceeding it is when you're faced with a motion for disqualification. Okay, so note, though, this is the Crowley decision doesn't follow the model rules. Under 1.9, Wiener was obviously conflicted from representing the school district. So under 1.10a, that conflict would have been imputed to the rest of the Scariano law firm, and the firm would have been disqualified. Okay? So under the model rules, there's no rebuttable presumption for a lawyer that's moving to a firm, only for the lawyer who's moved from the firm. Okay? So again, recognizing there are a lot of cases out there. Any of you who've worked in law firms are probably shocked to hear that the model rules don't allow for screening, because it's such a given in this day and age in a number of jurisdictions, but it definitely is still out there in some states. Okay. So let's go into can we hire the guy on page 292. So Scott, let's say you're the in-house ethics counsel that's advising the law firm in this situation. Sorry, yeah.
I'm sorry, before we get started.
Yeah.
You said there was a rebuttable presumption, near rebuttable presumption when they move to the firm or from the firm?
So if Wiener is moving, if Wiener has worked on the case, there's going to be an irrebuttable presumption under the model rule.
No, in terms of where he goes. If he's leaving the firm.
Right.
Okay. I get it.
Okay. Great. Okay. Scott, you're about to have earned your first piece of candy. all right. So what's going on in this can we hire the guy problem?
So we've got this guy, Monk. Basically graduated from some law school. He has he's an associate at a firm in Indiana, but his wife wants to begin a residency in Chicago, where KGR has an office.
Right.
So Monk writes to them about employment. He's interested. Unfortunately, it seems like they have some overlap in cases that both firms handle. KGR basically does defense work for Admiral, and Monk's old firm handled two cases against Admiral, Cricket and Beamblin. And he worked on the Cricket case.
Okay, so Monk worked on this case. And Bin Blue, he didn't? Am I getting that right?
Right.
All right, but his firm represented both of these plaintiffs in their lawsuits against Admiral, and these are two separate cases, right?
Right.
Okay. So, and now the issue is Monk wants to move to KGR, right?
Right.
Okay, so what's the issue then that's been presented to you as in-house counsel?
I mean, it just seems right off the bat, you know, is there a substantial relationship between the two cases? And I think clearly there is, at least with Crates, it's the same exact
right.
case. So I would think there would be this irrebuttable presumption on 1.9a, because he clearly worked on the case.
Right. So we're talking about this one, the Cricket case.
Right.
Right. So here we've got a lawyer who works on this case switches sides to another law firm, and the question becomes, you know, what's the conflict? Is this imputed or not? So you're rightfully saying that under 1.9, this would be an imputed conflict because he worked on the case and he clearly had confidences. And unlike Cromley, which also allowed for screening as a second way of getting around it, unless you've got what? You're not going to be able to do it. What's the only other way you can do it under the model rule? Right. Unless you can get informed consent of the client, you're not going to be able to do it under the model rule. What about this situation?
Yeah, there's an even weirder situation with the fact that the Indiana firm is part of this group with 10 plaintiff law firms representing toaster oven claims, and basically they discuss and share legal research together and information. And it just seemed to me that if Admiral is the big client to KGR, and if that's who they mainly defend, and if these 10 firms go against Admiral, or if they've had proceedings, or if they share information about that, Monk might have learned about it. Now, it says that he didn't learn, he never attended any of these meetings and things, but I feel like he would have to give affidavits presenting that he never received any type of information, maybe where his department was, it was far away from any of the, you know, the drawers of the case files and things like that.
Right, and there also may have been some spillover. I mean, if they're both suing the same defendant within the firm, there may have been some sharing of strategy or something like that where he somehow got wind of some of these, some of the facts from this case. Okay. So, as you say, you'd want to get an affidavit. Okay, so that's the actual... So, let's say he didn't actually work on the case and no confidential information was shared. Then what? Under the rule.
I guess if he didn't work on the case, would we be in a 1.9B situation?
Yes.
And then he'd have to come forth, you know, because he's in the firm, maybe he obtained confidential information. He'd have to come forth sort of rebutting
right.
that.
Okay, so how does this practically work? Because the situation here is the firm wants to hire Monk. So the hiring partner has come to you and said, what do I do here? Let's assume for the moment that it's a model rules jurisdiction. What are you going to say?
I don't know. It just doesn't seem like a good fit to come, but I guess that's not a good question.
I mean, what are your options? You can say to the hiring partner, you can hire him under the following circumstances. One...
Well, have him submit affidavits showing that he never worked on that, you know, in the case.
Right.
And that he never obtained any confidential information of sharing of the clients. And that he never received information with regard to the legal research and information, the investigations and laboratory tests.
Right. Okay. So that handles that situation. What about this problem? Okay. So, and that's one way of dealing with it. Is there any way to
consent for that? Otherwise,
all you got is consent. That's exactly right. So if you can't get the consent of the parties, in this case at least, then it's a no-go. So what are you? Okay. So practically speaking, any other option? They really want to hire Monk.
They can't screen him off, right?
Can't screen them off under the model rules. Now you're understanding the absurdity of the model rules. Because let's say Monk is working in California and he's going to go to the Chicago firm or whatever, to the Chicago office of this new firm. It's a little bizarre. Obviously, what happens is this ends up hindering his job prospects, this model rule.
Don't they, like, do a balancing test? I read in the information that we want to balance sort of a young attorney.
Theoretically, yeah, but the rule is the way that it is. Right.
I'm not sure what...
Any other ideas? I mean, what else could you do? Yeah? Sorry? You could. I mean, you might be able to withdraw just from the cricket case and just have local counsel or something like that handle just this case. But you'd have to talk with Admiral about it.
Wouldn't there still be the issue of confidential information? No. If you knew that confidential information, you would still be bringing it.
Well, then at least it wouldn't be imputed because they're no longer working on this case and he's no longer working on it. So it can't be used against Cricket in any way. And he would still have to, remember under the rule, it still requires you to keep confidences regardless. So even if you overcome the presumption and you move and it's okay, you still have to keep confidences of your former client. So he could theoretically do that. Certainly the informed consent, though, is the best ticket out of here. Unclear whether or not Cricket's... I would guess Cricket's not going to give that informed consent. Yeah.
That's not a problem dropping clients to get a good lawyer? Like, it kind of sounds like the Hofstede situation a little bit.
It does. That tends to be more when the law firm does it rather than the lawyer. Because here, what's happening is Monk is actually, this is a job choice. I mean, he's moving from one firm to another. He's not dropping Cricket to get a more lucrative client while staying at the firm. That's clearly a no-no. That's the typical hot potato issue, to make the person a former client rather than a current client. Yep.
You said that most jurisdictions don't have screening, or that they do have screening?
The majority of jurisdictions do have screening and permit it in some capacity. And even if it's not in the rules, oftentimes what happens is there's what's called judicial screening, where the judges will basically read it into the rules and allow for it. And so that happens in a number of jurisdictions where they don't allow for it specifically in the rules, but they'll just go ahead and decide that enough facts, that, you know, they've been persuaded that sufficient measures were taken. So literally in every jurisdiction around the country, screening mechanisms are being used because they're anticipating motions for disqualification, and so they're going to want to try and offer that this, you know, has happened, and hopefully they'll be able to convince the court to implement screen and to allow for screening.
So practically speaking, this is just a law class problem. This has nothing really to do.
No, because there are some jurisdictions that still are pretty adamant about it and don't allow for screening and still follow the model rules. So you never know what jurisdiction you're going to be in. Yeah. Okay, so good. Does everybody get that analysis? All right. What's your favorite kind of candy, Scott? If I have it.
Something with chocolate.
Nestle Crunch? Do you like crisp rice? Oops. That's okay. All right. So anybody who talks in class will start getting their candies. Okay, so the other issue I was just about to point out is thinking about if Illinois permits screening, and this is another thing that's a real practical reality. If Illinois permits the screening but Indiana doesn't, then what happens? You read about Rule 8.5, right, about saying that basically where the rule of the court where the matter is pending is what applies, but the jurisdiction may not necessarily follow 8.5. That's basically the conflicts of the conflicts rule. So you have to think about, gee, what happens if I'm practicing in New York and I'm practicing in Massachusetts, and you know, do I need to be following both rules, and what happens if it's allowed in one jurisdiction but not in another? So that's another aspect. But certainly, you know, at a minimum, if Monk's hired, the firm's going to need to anticipate that there's going to be a future disqualification motion coming down the line, and they're certainly going to want to advise Admiral about it if they're going to hire Monk. Okay? I just wanted, the other piece of the material from last week that I wanted to flag was this issue about non-lawyer conflicts. More recently, you're starting to see a couple of decisions out there where non-lawyers who have been exposed to confidential information, and when I say non-lawyers, I mean you, I mean summer associates, I mean paralegals, legal secretaries, legal interns of any kind, who are exposed to confidential information while they're working in a legal setting, that opens the doors for a conflicts discussion to happen when they move to a new job. So, for example, let's say you're working at a law firm over the summer, and you're working on a securities arbitration case, and then you come back to Hofstra in the fall and you sign up for the securities arbitration clinic. And it turns out that you get assigned to work on a case that is against your old law firm, and the old law firm is on the other side. Guess what? You've got a conflict of interest. And there are a number of courts that are now viewing that as a problem, and they'll end up disqualifying you, so you won't be able to work on the case, nor will anybody else in the clinic be able to work on the case, potentially. The way that they are getting around this, most jurisdictions, the vast majority of jurisdictions that have begun to rule on these non-lawyer conflict settings, are actually allowing for evidence of screening. So, they're reading screening into the rules, even if they don't exist there, because they're recognizing that these are kind of pseudo-lawyers who are operating in legal settings, getting confidential information, aren't necessarily able to be disciplined by the rules, but certainly the lawyers who are supervising them could be. And so what they're looking for is evidence of proper screening mechanisms. And we've had to deal with this in the past with clinical programs where this kind of conflict has come up a couple of times. And so what we have to do is implement screening mechanisms and put them into place, and that becomes quite lovely when you're working in such a small setting. But again, I've seen cases with legal secretaries. I've seen it come up with paralegals a number of times, and there's been a number of cases with law students as well. So keep that in mind with your future job prospects. Okay, so let's move into the transient lawyers and the multi-jurisdictional practice material from today. So the first question I have for you is, we got into this a little bit right after that pro bono lecture, the Wittgenstein lecture, about this issue of what constitutes the practice of law. And before we get into trying to define that, I want to ask you to think about what traditionally have been the concerns behind states' rules that prohibit unauthorized practice of law. And recognizing not every state even has a rule that says, what unauthorized practice of law is and that it's prohibited. But for those states that do have such a rule, what's the theory behind it? Why do we have such a rule in the first place? Yeah, Sam. Okay, what?
Client protection from fraud.
Client protection from what? From fraud. Okay, so tell me more about that.
Well, essentially, you don't want. It's like if somebody's like, oh yeah, I'm a doctor and I'm going to diagnose you with cancer and here's your medicine. You don't want somebody kind of out there saying, oh yeah, I'm a lawyer. I know how to diagnose your problems and here's a remedy. Like, you want somebody who's knowledgeable in the area.
So it's consumer protection, right? So your idea is that it's consumer, it's designed to protect clients, and also because this is a licensed profession. And so if it's a licensed profession, you want people to actually be licensed.
Right, I just think that, yeah, and because we are a licensed profession, there's a level of knowledge that one should have to advise those people.
Okay.
And that's how it has been in their ears, so.
All right, so there's a certain bar of knowledge that we want to have lawyers meet. Okay, what's your favorite kind of candy?
Let's go with Snickers.
What else? What other reasons do we have for unauthorized practice of law rules? Yeah,
I think one justification might be to prevent disbarred lawyers from being able to practice the profession without receiving authorization from the courts or the bar association. Once you lose your license, you shouldn't be able to continue on as if nothing happens.
So unscrupulous people who might be trying to, right, so to pretend that they're a lawyer. Okay, that kind of goes in connection with what Diana was saying. What else? Yeah, Lauren?
Ensure efficiency and such in the court, make sure that everybody's at a level of, I guess, a
certain standard. Level of knowledge. Okay. Yeah.
I'm not concerned about that, but you want to make sure they know the laws of that jurisdiction, because even if they're licensed in New York, California is going to be different.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Selfish point of view, we don't want people taking our business.
Exactly, and honestly, that's really what it's all about. It's all about, hey, there's only a certain pot of money out there for representing clients, and we don't want anybody else to have it other than the people who actually went through the hell of going to law school and trying to take the bar exam and passing the bar. Right? So it's all about that monopoly. It's all about protecting that monopoly. And yes, you've got concerns about consumer protection and making sure everybody's knowledgeable and all that. Don't buy that. It's really not about that. It's really about the money. The other thing is, theoretically, there's a lot of, as you saw in the Bierbauer case, there's a lot of grayness about what actually constitutes the practice of law. So, theoretically, at least, the legislatures that have tried to define it are trying to actually give notice to non-lawyers about what they can and cannot do legally. Okay, so it eliminates this uncertainty for the non-lawyer service providers out there. What else? It's protecting the interests of the lawyers, but what else is it also? What do you have to do when you pass the bar and you go and you get your, you know, you raise your hand and you get sworn in? What's the first thing they're going to ask you for as you're, before you leave the courthouse? Money. Write a check for your fee, for your license. That's exactly right. And in some places, it's really steep. D.C., it's like $1,200, and I don't even live there anymore, and I'm still paying for it. So there's a financial incentive for the bar associations to collect that money to help fund the disciplinary committees and all the other things that we do as far as the licensing features go. There's certainly regulatory concerns in being able to effectively police lawyers and hold them accountable. So even for people who might be barred in other states, the people at least that you know are barred in your state, you know that they're, because they're paying for their registration fee, you know their contact information, you know how to reach them in case there's ever any complaint that's filed against them, you know how to regulate them. There's also, with respect to the monopoly piece, it's not just about protecting the monopoly of lawyers in the state against non-lawyers, but it's also historically been, although less so now, about also protecting the monopoly against out-of-state lawyers who come in and poach your business. Okay, so that's been another piece of it. The problem, of course, is that a lot of these unauthorized practice of law rules came about a long time ago, and times have changed. Firms have expanded. We now have multi-state, we have international law firms that have offices in London and Moscow and Paris and South Africa and all over the place. So we have multinational, multi-state practices. We also now have an increasing concern about being able to provide sufficient representation for the poor and for moderate income clients. So that's resulted in a lot of efforts to provide what are called, and we've talked about this before when we talked about Bates, these kind of unbundled legal services at minimal cost. So the idea that non-lawyers could provide certain kinds of services, forms, limited representation for clients who don't necessarily need a stand-up lawyer to go ahead and represent them in a court proceeding. There's also been a number of technological advances with the internet that's permitting lawyers to practice law in a virtual universe. So they're never setting foot outside of their office, but they could be representing somebody in any number of different states, none of which they are licensed to practice in. So absent an outright denial of practicing in state without a license, are there less restrictive ways of doing this where we could meet some of those policy interests that we mentioned just a few minutes ago? So maybe it's things like notices to clients or consumers. Maybe it could be dealt with through some kind of a more limited licensing procedure that makes it easier for out-of-state lawyers to be able to come into practice. Or maybe we have what are called limited licenses for non-lawyers who haven't gone through all of the hoopla of going to law school and passing the bar exam, but maybe have been able to show some level of education or experience that would qualify them to be kind of limited representatives of some kind. Or maybe there are other kinds of regulatory options. So with that in mind, let's think about what we can come up with for what it means to practice law. How would we define the practice of law? What do you think? Yeah, Diana? So helping with legal remedies for those with legal problems. In what kind of settings?
Litigation.
Can anybody see anything that might fall outside of this realm that would still, in your mind, constitute the practice of law?
Yeah, well, we talked about earlier, it's not just legal remedies, it's also offering advice and guidance.
So, inherently, non-legal remedies may be involved. Okay. What else?
Yeah. Well, litigation, ADR, and counseling limits it to things that are, there's some sort of conflict. There could be contracts and things of that nature that wouldn't fall within.
So, transactional work? What in your mind would be legal transactional work that a lawyer has to do, but that a non-lawyer couldn't do?
Stuff that's not just filling in the blank. Something that...
Or what does it require? It's tough, isn't it? Kind of like pornography, you know it when you see it, yeah?
Like legal definitions or legal terms, like if we're talking about a non-compete clause, that's something that has like legal definition, that has a standard that's legally defined, I guess?
So, if there's a contract that has legal definitions and legal terms, the lawyer needs to draft it?
It helps that lawyer. No, a lawyer doesn't have to draft it, but then it doesn't.
Would it be the practice of law if a lawyer was draft was if a non-lawyer was drafting it?
Probably not. You don't. There's no rule that says you need a lawyer to draft a contract.
Hold that. Okay, Adam.
I think maybe creating legal rights or obligations.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I think if you are writing a non-compete clause, it creates obligations on behalf of the party signing it. If someone comes to work for your company and they have unique knowledge having worked for your company, so you have to sign a non-compete clause, that creates an obligation on their part. There'll be consequences if they don't abide by that agreement. So I think by binding the person, that is what I would characterize as practicing law.
So what if I drafted a non-compete clause, and I'm in-house counsel at my company, and could I then just say, this is the standard non-compete clause, you know, you can make, you know, subtle changes if you want, but this is the standard non-compete clause. Could I have a non-lawyer make some changes to that contract and then ask somebody else to enter into the contract with him? Would that be the practice of law?
I think so. If it affects anything that bore on that clause, I think... I really think it would be practicing.
Anybody a real estate agent in here? Or married, or know a real estate agent? That's what real estate agents do all the time, right? Don't they add in terms, delete terms?
Well, I think that there's a difference between, I think, filling in the blanks on standard forms and something that would be germane to, I don't know.
Interestingly enough, real estate agents are the ones who are almost always, you see any number of lawsuits that are disciplinary proceedings or criminal proceedings that are brought against real estate agents for unauthorized practice of law. So they're definitely on that gray cusp in a lot of situations in a number of jurisdictions, depending on how it's defined. What else? Do we feel confident that with this definition?
Yep.
Well, I kind of want to challenge the creating legal rights and obligations.
Okay.
For example, my parents went on a trip and they left my cousin as a babysitter and they drafted up a contract that says if they pass on the trip and you know who would get custody of my little brother. That would be creating legal rights and obligations, but they didn't have an attorney when they did it. So I'm not necessarily sure like, if you would need an attorney to draft that up or if the or if we're saying what they drafted up would be void in the court.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I know exactly. Okay, so I'm going to put a question mark next to this. We had another question mark about this because it seems to not incorporate the transactional work. I think I had a question about this, about substituting terms or whatever. What else? What else do lawyers do? And if you've ever hired a lawyer, why did you go to a lawyer to do whatever it was, provide whatever service it was, as opposed to a non-lawyer? Fran?
Maybe, obviously, they have access to the court, so you go to the lawyer, they request what you're doing to intervention, and they get that court procedure going on, because a layperson really doesn't know how to get that process rolling.
Okay, so certainly with respect to litigation, they are kind of the exclusive, unless you're pro se, providers of advocacy representation, right? Because you can't just hire your neighbor to go in and represent you in court unless your neighbor is authorized to practice law in that jurisdiction. You could represent yourself, but you can't get your neighbor to go do it, okay? What else? What else do lawyers do? What are you learning in law school to do?
Advocate.
And what are you doing when you advocate? Yes, applying legal principles, okay? Okay, so there's a certain aspect about the substantive knowledge of the law. What else? What else do you do when you're a lawyer? When your client comes to you with a problem, what do you do? Yeah.
Either for the best legal solution or just the best solution in general for that client.
So you're solving problems and you're using what? You're using
your legal knowledge.
Knowledge and what else? Judgment, right? You're using judgment in making your determinations. And that judgment may be based on substantive law, your knowledge of substantive law, your knowledge of procedural rules. It's going to be based on your experience. And, I mean, what's interesting is this notion that, you know, as far as adult learning theory goes, you go from being a novice to being an expert. And part of the reason we go to expert practitioners of any kind is because they have a wealth of knowledge that they've built on, and their judgment is stemming from that knowledge. If I go to court and I do the same thing 5 times and I get the same result, I'm not going to do that again. I'm going to tell my client, I've done this 5 times and I always get the same result. We're not doing that. That's not a good option. Okay? The non-lawyer isn't necessarily going to have that experience and be able to build on that. So you can see that. Okay, and then there's one other thing. What else do we do? What else is a really important, there's also a discipline rule attached to it, and we talked about it when we talked about what these discipline rules are based on. What's the substantive law that these discipline rules stem from? We talked about it in the first class of the semester. What do we have with our client?
Agency
and what else?
Fiduciary.
We are fiduciaries. We are in a relationship of trust with our clients. We have to safeguard their property. We have to be loyal to them. We have to keep confidences. So all these fiduciary obligations that come with this license is all important, and it's the reason why you're in this class, right? Theoretically, it's also required. So there's a fiduciary relationship. Okay, so obviously this is not an easy definition, and it's a fluid definition, and it's why there's a lot of litigation over what constitutes the practice of law. And there are a lot of questions that come up. You know, can we ever begin to unbundle some of these aspects of the practice of law to the point that it no longer becomes the practice of law, such that non-lawyers can fill in and provide representation? We talked about this a few weeks ago. It may be that there are some services up here that are so complex or difficult that we don't want anybody other than lawyers to do them. So the problem is, if we create a really broad definition of the practice of law, then we can create provisions that would allow exceptions for certain people to practice law within that umbrella of the broad definition. Okay, so we could make it hugely expansive and then have a number of exceptions for, you know, you and you and you and you and you. who aren't licensed to practice, but we're going to give you an exception for whatever reason to be able to engage in some of these activities without a formal license. We could create a limited definition, but then, so we could make it a much more restricted view of the practice of law, but then we risk having a lot of people engaging in any number of these services without the regulatory oversight that we talked about as one of our guiding principles behind why we have this rule in the first place. All right, so that's all a big setup for Beer Brower. So, Jessica, can you give us an overview of what happened in Beer Brower?
Beer Brower was a New York law firm that worked with ESQ, the California Corporation, and in a dispute with Tandem, which was another California corporation. And there was some sort of dispute as to their fee agreement, and that's why this case came up. And basically, ESQ didn't pay for the Beer Brower based on an unauthorized practice of law.
Right. They actually sued them for malpractice, and then the firm sued to collect the fee. Okay, so take us back. So what was the nature of what services were provided by the firm?
Well, two of the lawyers from the firm traveled to California.
And where's the firm based?
In New York. It's incorporated in New York.
Okay.
And they traveled to California several times to deal with, I think they've initiated arbitration with Tandem.
Right.
And they also just went there to discuss matters pertaining to business deals. They discussed strategy. They negotiated with Tandem. They tried to reach a settlement. So they were there consistently doing things pertaining to business deals.
All right. So they gave advice. We didn't have that up here, but that might be another one on the list. They filed a demand for arbitration, right? They were negotiating on their behalf. They were discussing disputes and different strategies, so maybe using things like judgment or applying legal principles. Okay. Do they associate with any local counsel?
No.
No. Okay. What was the issue then before the court?
Beer Brower has violated Section 6125 of California law, which is that no person shall practice law in California unless a member of state bar.
Right, so that's basically their unauthorized practice of law statute. So they're saying that this New York firm, these lawyers came in who were not licensed to practice in California, came in and they were practicing law in violation of the statute. And what's the law firm's response? What did they argue?
Well, I guess their arguments were based on the fact that they... I know that one of the issues were whether what the practice of law meant and what in California meant. I don't know if that's what Beer Brower argued.
Okay, so how did the court define it? Because it wasn't defined in the statute, right?
Right.
Okay.
The court defined practice of law as doing and performing services in a court of justice in any matter pending therein throughout its various states and in conformity with the adopted rules of procedure, and it didn't have to be litigation, it could be advice, instrument, or contract preparation.
Okay.
And in California, was sufficient contact with California to render the nature of legal service and client representation.
Right. So does this harken you back to civil procedure? Do you start to twitch a little bit when you think about, you know, minimum contacts and that kind of thing? Sounds very familiar, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So the court started to get into this whole discussion about the contacts with California. Why was that relevant? Why did it examine, you know, how many times the lawyers came to California? Why is that important?
Well, because there's the 6125 can't govern anything that they did in New York based on California law. Well, no, that's not true. But them coming up to California alone wasn't the only issue. If they had done, like, substantial work regarding this dispute and California law, then that's even harder too.
And what does the court actually decide about the stuff that they did in New York versus the stuff in California?
The stuff that they did in New York, they said that they could, I think they remanded it, and they could recover fees for that as long as it didn't constitute the practice of law in California, even though it was performed in California.
Right. Okay, so they looked at basically this quantitative analysis and the nature of the activities in the state. So they use these phrases like, attenuated contacts with the state is not going to be sufficient. There's got to be this kind of continuous relationship with California client or sufficient activities in the state of some kind. But it doesn't necessarily require a physical presence, right? Okay. What do you think? Was this the right decision?
Well, I think based on the fact that I'm not really sure what happened, but both sides disagreed on whether Berber ever represented that they were admitted in California. So I think that based on that, someone was being less than honest, or someone was seeking, wasn't doing their research on the firm that they were using. So I think that they did overstep.
And in your mind, does an arbitration come close enough to being in a litigation context?
Yeah, something in the dissent is discussed. I think maybe it was a Barron case where basically this case said that here arbitration wasn't enough, but in Barron, I think maybe it was preparation for arbitration. No, this was preparation for arbitration.
Right.
And this was preparation was more law than the actual arbitration, and it kind of didn't really make sense.
And here they actually filed the demand for arbitration on behalf of the clients.
Right.
Right. So in your mind, do you feel like arbitration comes close enough?
I do.
What about mediation?
Well, I don't know, because you don't have to apply the rule of law exactly in those resolutions. So I think that it can. I think that you have, maybe it's fact-based now.
But it becomes a little difficult, right, when you're beginning to think about, I mean, there are lots of people who have lawyers in mediation, lots of people who don't. But at what point could I hire my neighbor to represent me in a mediation proceeding? At what point could we have law students representing people in mediations and not require any kind of a rule for them to practice, a student practice rule?
I think just because you can have other, non-lawyers, doesn't mean that when a lawyer does that it's not the practice of law.
Good point. Good point. All right, let's, Dan. I was just going to say, why don't we take a quick break and then we'll come back and start getting into some of the problems for the rest of the class time. Does somebody have the attendance sheet? Somewhere, right? Put it out there. Okay. I don't think I got it there.
What's your show?
It already happened.
Oh, did it?
Sorry. Yeah, it was a couple of weeks ago.
Was it a good show?
It was great.
Okay, did everybody get a piece of candy? Is there any left? Wow. Wow, all it looks like is Dodd Ranchers and Tootsie Rolls left over. Okay. All right, so obviously Bierbauer answers this more definitive question, at least in California, about whether to include in the practice of law activities relating to arbitration proceedings. There was a huge brouhaha over Bierbauer when it came out. Attorneys hated this case for understandable reasons. And since that time, a number of states and also the ABA have clearly come out and said that they will permit out-of-state lawyers to come in and temporarily appear in arbitration proceedings in the court, and that will not violate any authorized practice of law rules. So they don't have to actually be admitted. And if you look, the ABA, the Model Rule 5.5C3, that's where you see reference to it under the ABA Model Rules. All right, so I said earlier that one of the ways that you can deal with this unauthorized practice of law issue is if you create a broad definition and then you create basically categories of providers of those services or of legal services who are going to be included within the realm of practicing law and who that state or that jurisdiction deems to be accountable and competent to provide those services. So you can create these kinds of categories. Some examples might be clearly attorneys who are licensed in the state. Those who might be licensed out of state who would, can come in and temporarily provide legal services. Usually what you see, as you see in the model rules as well, is some provision that requires the engagement of local counsel or pro hoc vice admission of some kind, and they're authorized by the court to do so. They might allow for, as I just mentioned, attorneys to come in and temporarily engage in mediations or arbitrations, so non-kind of formal litigation settings. In-house lawyers is another realm where you see an overly permissive allowance for them to be practicing law even if they aren't barred in the state. Law students that are supervised by clinical professors or in-state lawyers of some kind, as well as paralegals, often are able to engage in some limited amount of the practice of law in a number of jurisdictions. So if you look just briefly at Rule 5.5, the way that it's structured is the following. It kind of has, in the first paragraph, this broad statement that lawyers can't engage in the unauthorized practice of law. Obviously, they can't, under the discipline rules, include non-lawyers in that realm. They can only focus on lawyers because this is a law, a discipline rule for lawyers. For non-lawyers, does anybody have any sense of how states might go after non-lawyers who are engaging in the practice of law?
Fraud,
criminal proceedings, right. There are actually criminal codes out there that you violate if you're a non-lawyer and you're engaging in the practice of law. It's often a misdemeanor of some kind. I don't think there are any felonies. Okay, so that's paragraph A. It has this general, you know, it's a no-no to engage in unauthorized practice of law by lawyers. And then B basically says, except where permitted otherwise, unauthorized lawyers can't establish offices or other kinds of systemic and continuous presence in the state for the practice of law or represent that the lawyer is licensed there. Okay? Three then has this exception for lawyers who are providing services on a temporary basis but who are basically licensed in some other state. So I'm licensed in Massachusetts. I come in to New York. I temporarily provide some kind of legal services. I've got to associate a lawyer who's admitted in the state and who will actively participate in the matter. And it's got to be reasonably related to a pending or potential proceeding before a tribunal in this or some other jurisdiction if I'm coming in. And then I'm going to have to get some kind of pro hoc vice admission or authority by the court. So that's going to be one kind of situation where we're going to allow out-of-state lawyers to come in and provide some kind of temporary legal services. Another situation is where under D, there's an exception for lawyers in good standing in another state who are providing legal services, and they're basically in-house counsel, and where there's no pro hoc vice admission that's required. Or if the services are otherwise authorized to be provided in this jurisdiction. So in other words, they're punting to the definition of the practice of law within that jurisdiction. So if you're allowed to practice as a non-lawyer or an out-of-state lawyer under some statutory definition of the practice of law, then you're going to be okay and you're not going to violate this rule. Okay? So that's basically the gist of what I want you to know about 5.5. Bierbauer also raises this different question, which is a little bit more difficult, and that is, to what extent should a state be able to discipline out-of-state lawyers? In that case, it was these New York lawyers who were coming into California. So how much are we going to allow states to discipline out-of-state lawyers who are found to be engaging in unauthorized practice of law in their state? In other words, it's kind of long-arm discipline, right? So what they do is they basically talk about if the harm, if it causes harm in the state, if they've had these kind of contacts with the state. And in essence, this is really a personal jurisdiction question. At what point does the discipline board have the authority to have jurisdiction over to discipline the out-of-state lawyer? And states are in disagreement over this, not surprisingly. So some basically say it's kind of minimum contacts. The ABA and the other jurisdictions say you've got to have this continuous presence in order to be able to exercise jurisdiction in some way. You saw a reference to that Condon v. McHenry case out of California that talked about how if the lawyer is applying the law, that state's law in some way, then that in and of itself might be sufficient contacts with the state for them to exercise jurisdiction, especially if it's a state resident who you're applying the law to. But the big ticket question is this kind of virtual reality of the practice of law, where lawyers are online, in chat rooms, providing legal advice, but they're never physically entering into the state. And that's really still a huge gray area out there. And how much contact, you're beginning to see a parallel discussion as you are in the civil procedure realm under the personal jurisdiction arguments. You're beginning to see the same arguments beginning to track with respect to the jurisdiction of states to be able to discipline out-of-state lawyers. So that gives you a little bit more of an overview of that. Why don't we jump into the local office national practice on page 572. Liz, why don't you walk us through this problem? Yeah, sure.
So what are people doing in representing the virtual board? It's
a great question. So part of it depends on whether or not the state has enacted some version of 5.5. Believe it or not, a number of states actually don't have any kind of a resolution to this issue formally in any kind of a discipline rule. So they don't have anything that, for example, talks about Rule 8.5 and what law applies and what authority you have to be able to exercise jurisdiction over lawyers. So that's one huge complicating factor, because then you're basically dependent on it having come up in some kind of a discipline proceeding or case law. So it's more of a common law determination. And again, the best I can tell you is what little I have seen out there, and I really haven't seen that much. There's not a lot out there. Is it tends to be tracking the personal jurisdiction case law with respect to the cyberspace contacts. So I don't know if you did anybody get into that in your civil procedure classes at all. There's beginning to be some cases that are coming up in that realm where they're treating it similarly. So are you applying, let's say it's New York, lawyers who are working on a California case for a California client. Is the client a resident of California? That's going to be a big one, because then they're looking for that protection of their own residence in some way. They'll also look at, are they applying California law or some other law? Is there some contact that they're having as far as emails, faxes, telephone calls? Are they negotiating with other parties or having any contact with other parties on behalf of the client in California in some way, even if it is virtual? So those are the kind of contacts that you begin to see. Is there ever any travel there? Is there any solicitation of business in California? Is it a national law firm that advertises in some capacity there? So it's a lot of the same kind of analysis.
Really,
what?
I mean, there's no damages once you file per se. But, like, the same issue is with my analogy, and doctors, like, giving medical advice over online. If you put in your symptoms, and they're like, oh, sounds like
Right, so if there, you could do a malpractice claim, theoretically, certainly, but then you could, I mean, what we're talking about more is the discipline issue and the authority to discipline in some way. But what then happens is California would discipline the New York lawyer and then say, and contact the New York disciplinary board and say, you should discipline your lawyer and give our decision full faith and credit. And so then the New York board has to decide whether or not to give it full faith and credit. And that's the dispute that you oftentimes see happening as well, where a state makes a different determination than the one that actually disciplined them. Okay, so Liz, local office, national practice.
All right. So this is a lawyer who helps highly paid executives negotiate their compensation packages. His office is in D.C., but his clients are nationwide. I think that even though, you know, it's often the corporations or the companies that pay his fees, it's something that he negotiates for, his clients would still probably consider the people with whom he's helping to get the packages set up for.
I'm sorry, say that again?
I think that his clients are the people who he's helping to get the packages set up for. It doesn't matter that he often has the companies themselves pay his fees.
Right.
He still has this client relationship with.
Okay. Anything else we know about any of the services he's providing?
Yeah, he handles all of his work from his office, typically through fax, email, phone, and express mail. Sometimes he does meet them in the home cities of his clients, which isn't always where the prospective offices are, employers' offices are. And there are times when he'll go to those cities instead, where the employer's office is.
So he also will go to employers' offices.
Right.
Okay.
And then I don't know if there is an advertising question here in some capacity. He does have a Google website that provides his contact information.
Alright, so website, contact info,
available on Google.
Okay.
We also know that the agreements that he drafts will often dictate whose law will govern.
Okay.
In the event of a dispute, and it's usually the place where the company is located. But what I wasn't really sure about was, is that the agreement that he's doing between the client and the company, or is that between him and his client?
Between the client and the company.
Okay.
Okay. And he's drafting those. Okay.
And he has read the Burbauer case, and now he's very concerned about if he's doing anything wrong.
Okay. So, what do we think? First question right out of the box is he practicing law? Because we know that under 5.5, that's the first question we got to think about. Is he engaging in unauthorized practice of law? So, in other words, what is the practice of law? What do you think? Do the model rules tell us what the practice of law is?
Right. Well, as you know, we don't really have a set definition on what the practice
right.
of law is.
Right. So the model rules are literally silent, and they punt to whatever the jurisdiction is. Okay? So what would be the first thing that you would want to do?
Well, the first thing I'd want to do is look at the jurisdiction that I'm practicing in for that specific client and see if there's maybe other decisions on this, maybe other ADA opinions from that jurisdiction.
Right. Bummer for you, because that's like hours and hours of research, because we have no idea how many clients he's representing in all the different states that he has contact with, right?
So, because we're going to want to not only look at the DC rules, but also all the rules where he has any kind of contact whatsoever with
right.
clients or the employers.
I think it's rule, I think it's 8.5
mm-hmm.
to the disciplinary authority being of the jurisdiction that you're in. He, I think it might be a pain in the ass, but like he has to find out what he's up against in each of these jurisdictions to do what he can and can't do.
Right, because the rule of that jurisdiction will be applied even in D.C., as you say, under 8.5, right? Because that's basically the choice of law rule. Okay. So model rules are silent. You're going to have to do a lot of research about what constitutes the practice of law. Inevitably, some of those jurisdictions won't even have any case law or statutory assistance for you whatsoever. So let's look, let's assume that we have no real clear working definition. What in your mind begins to spark some red flags?
You mean with what he's doing
right.
in the practice of law?
Right.
He's negotiating terms for a contract, or what will ultimately become a contract.
Okay.
He is drafting agreements, again, between his client and their employer.
Okay.
He's offering legal advice to at least the client, with respect to their
okay.
situation.
Okay.
And he's just offering an expertise that you should be, I guess, licensed to have or to offer.
Okay. All right. So he's definitely, he's negotiating the economic terms of packages. He's choosing choice of law provisions, which means he's got to be able to articulate to his client the impact and the consequences of those choice of law provisions within the agreements. Certainly, there's labor issues that are at play. He's drafting documents with legal rights. So probably these clients are going to want the benefit of confidentiality and privilege, right, as he's negotiating and giving them advice. Okay. So a number of red flags that begin to sound similar to some of the list over here. So you probably want to say to him, you know what, it sounds to me like there's a number of things here that are at least going to pass the giggle test, so to speak, of practicing law. Okay. So then what's the next question? So if you've decided that he's engaged in the practice of law, what's the next question you've got to ask yourself?
I know that there's something where he would have to inform, I think, his client that he is not authorized to practice.
Okay, where are you getting that from?
That was in a rule. 5.5, maybe?
Okay. Somebody else, see if you can find that. All right, so you keep going. All right, so
I think I know rule 5.5. They do say that a lawyer who is not admitted to practice in the jurisdiction cannot, except as authorized, establish an office or other systematic continuous presence in the jurisdiction. So I guess if it's going to be, is he in the jurisdiction?
Right, so the next question becomes, is the practice of law unauthorized? Right, so once you've actually determined that at least you're in a gray area of potential practice of law, and I think we're more than in a gray area in this regard, then you've got to ask the next question, which is the practice of law unauthorized? And so 5.5 obviously prohibits unauthorized practice of law, says if the lawyer isn't licensed in other states, they're engaged in the unauthorized practice of law if there's this systemic and continuous presence that you just talked about. So what do we think? Is there a systemic and continuous presence here?
I thought so, just even though he's not necessarily always there, he does travel there on occasion.
Okay.
He's entering into the state through fax, phone calls, emails. It fits into that technological, you know, virtual presence that we were speaking about before that's a cause for concern. And I think that under that, you know, ingrained in the jurisdiction that you're doing your work, then the fact that you're sitting somewhere in D.C. doesn't really change the fact that you're working in another jurisdiction.
What's great about these terms like continuous and systemic presence are they totally are what pay our bills as far as legal practice. We love those kind of ambiguous kinds of phrases, right? Because no one actually puts a number on, if you go there more than 10 times, you're absolutely engaging in continuous and systemic practice. Nobody ever says that. And also, does it mean going there virtually, going there physically? What does that mean? So
you'd certainly want to ask questions of him about how many times exactly are you going to each of these states? Are you going once? Are you going twice? How long are you staying? Are you staying overnight? Are you going in for 2 hours and leaving? Are you staying for weeks on end? Are you setting up temporary office space of any kind? Are you working in somebody else's office while you're there? Are you renting space of some kind, living space? These would all be kind of the fact questions that you would want to ask, because I don't think we have all that information in this problem yet. You'd probably definitely want to do some more digging. How many faxes, how many emails, how many phone calls are you making? Okay. And how many clients? Does he have one client in each state? Does he have 10 clients in each state? I think you also, going back to in answer to Diane's question, think about solicitation. Is he soliciting business of any kind? Is he advertising there in any way? Is his phone number listed? Even on his website, does he indicate, are there certain states where he represents clients? So those would all be questions you'd want to ask. Because at a certain point, he runs a risk of being there in a continuous and systemic way. Okay. So 5.5 says that if he's a lawyer in good standing in D.C., what might he be able to do? He could practice law if what?
If he's with another attorney, he associates with like an attorney of the jurisdiction.
So if he hires local counsel and if he's there temporarily, which he does seem to be going there temporarily, so he could associate with another lawyer who is licensed and who who's actively participating. And they've also got to arise out of or be reasonably related to the legal practice that he has in D.C. So this might provide greater protection for him, even though there's actually, I mean, you don't have a pro hoc vice situation because there's no litigation, but maybe what he wants to do is establish some kind of a relationship with a local lawyer who could just look over the contracts, and be involved in some way so that he's got that closer, so that he seems to be closer in line with what 5.5 says. Let's assume that that's the rule in that place. Yeah.
Is that enough to just do all the work and they look over the contract? I got the impression that like he needs to almost be by your side and do everything.
Again, actively participates, open to interpretation. You know, it certainly is further along than not having anybody at all. Probably any time there's any question about application of that state's law, you'd want to get that lawyer involved. You'd want to probably at least be copying the lawyer on all major correspondence. At a certain point, you're right, it may not be enough to constitute active participation. Okay, so this would seem to maybe, if he, without having associated a local lawyer, what do we think? Is he in violation of 5.5?
I think he could be, but then when you actually get to, say, like, his fees, which is what I'm most concerned about, I think that since he's, you know, there's a good chance he could still, under the severability doctrine, if it applies in the jurisdiction in which he's practicing, still collect a fee because a large amount of his work is being done
in D.C.
In D.C.
Right. So under the Bierbauer doctrine, yeah, there might be some aspect that he can get at least the work that he's doing totally in D.C.
My recommendation to him is that it would apply.
Right. So that's a fee issue, though. That's not a discipline issue.
As a discipline issue, I think that if he doesn't associate, he could very well be in trouble. But again, it depends on the, how they define or how they really look at it systematically.
So let's say another state where he's gone to, let's say he's gone down to Georgia, and he's gone a number of times, and we've determined that if he's engaging in the practice of law, and he hasn't engaged a local lawyer, and he's gone down there in a systematic and continuous way. So can Georgia then have jurisdiction over him? What happens? Let's play this out.
I think that under 8.5, he would be subject to their discipline, because it says a lawyer not admitted to this jurisdiction is also subject to the disciplinary authority of the jurisdiction.
Right. So they could certainly prohibit him from engaging in any further practice of law in the state.
Right.
But then they're also going to kick it potentially to D.C., right?
He's subject for D.C. and Georgia.
Right. And then D.C. has to decide whether or not they're going to give full faith and credit and how they're going to discipline him, if at all. Okay. So other than enlisting another local lawyer, is there any other advice that you might have for him?
Again, if we're under a Verbrauer jurisdiction, I would definitely recommend that in terms of fees, do as much work as possible in D.C. to avoid any dispute there.
Right, maybe have, and also maybe have the negotiations happen in D.C.
Right, get them to come to him. I mean, I know it's
right.
Really tougher, but...
There may also be a way to have D.C. law apply. So if he, part of the issue, remember, is that he's articulating which state's law is going to apply. He might be able to negotiate for D.C. law to apply.
Right.
So,
that
right. Probably not, but it's certainly an idea.
Yeah.
And if there's some state at a certain point with a number of contacts, you might recommend go ahead and see if you can waive in and just pay the bar fee, because at a certain point, far better to pay the fee and waive into the jurisdiction. If he's been in practice for a number of years, he can probably waive in and pay the fee, and then he avoids any potential discipline for unauthorized practice. If he's got sufficient business going on there, might be worth it if there are certain states where he tends to have repeat clients. Okay, good. All right, so let's jump to the admission to the bar material. So I wanted you to read this material, and sometimes I assign it and sometimes I don't. But it's obviously directly relevant to you and your upcoming admission to the bar. We're not going to spend, obviously, a lot of time on it, but I wanted to go through at least the two problems to give you a sense of how character and fitness committees are going to think about different kinds of applicants to the bar and how they're going to make their determinations. So typically, as you saw in the book, character and fitness committees will inquire into a couple of different areas. So the red flag areas tend to be mental health, honesty, integrity, personal life issues, and any kind of things like loyalty to America and the legal system in general. Okay, so those are kind of the four primary areas where you tend to see a closer analysis and a closer look of your application. And if you take note of the In re Mustafa case, where Mustafa's conduct during law school ultimately led to his denial of admission, that should be a fair warning to you that certainly law school is the prime time period where they're going to look for any kind of misconduct. And it can relate to things like, again, kind of the red flags or any kind of dishonest conduct, especially relating to finances or money of any kind, cheating, et cetera, in an academic setting. Criminal conduct during law school, especially as it might relate to things like fraud or misrepresentation, or other types of dishonest behavior, as well as drug and alcohol abuse. That tends to be a huge red flag for the committees, because that's often an indicator of future discipline problems. Lack of candor in your bar application or your law school application. If you remember in your law school application, we say very clearly to you, you have a duty to amend, and we ask you all of these questions about criminal background, disciplinary background, etc. There's a reason that we ask for those. They directly relate to your bar application. And we also tell you you have a continuing duty to amend as you go forward. And so, again, there's a reason that we ask for those, because they'll be asked of us when we're asked to certify you for admission to the bar. And serious mental health background, I say this with a little bit of a pause, because as a disability rights lawyer, I have a lot of issue with them digging too thoroughly into mental health background. And there are a lot of us out there who have argued vigorously with the states to get rid of any kind of questions that ask about people's mental health background. And there's been a lot of suggestion that in light of the Americans with Disabilities Act and some recent cases and recent statutory initiatives that this really is not an acceptable question on the bar application. And amazingly, a number of states still have it. A lot of them have gotten rid of them, but some of them still have them on the bar applications. Okay, yes? Certainly. But it's also a question of, first of all, we now have pretty strict rights about privacy, about mental health. I mean, just as nobody asks questions about your physical background, there's arguably you shouldn't be asking about mental health background. Obviously, if it gets to a serious enough level that you've been hospitalized for a significant time, or it has had a serious impact on your ability to function in some way on a daily level, then it might come into the realm of certain of competency questions. But the way that some of the questions are phrased are so broad that they're literally asking, have you ever seen a therapist? Have you ever seen a counselor? Have you ever taken any medication? Far beyond what would be considered relevant for purposes of competency to practice law. Okay. So let's get to shattered glass. And Brandon and Michael, I'm going to have you guys... let's say that you guys are serving on the character committee for Stephen Glass, and Brandon, I'm going to have you arguing that he should be denied admission, and Michael, that you should argue that he should be admitted. And why don't we start with, let's assume that you've reviewed the bar application, you know about his background as a journalist. So you're really at this, you're down to the wire here as far as making this determination. And Michael, why don't we start with you as far as the arguments that you would make in favor in your trying to persuade Brandon.
I would start off by saying that while there is like a code of journalism ethics, they're voluntary. You don't have to abide by them. They're not legally enforceable. So technically, you didn't really violate any.
Right, so you actually attached, which was great, went out and, do you have some reporter that you know or something? How did you just went out and researched it? So, right, so there's this notion of this kind of voluntary journalism ethics that you talked about in your memo before class. But your idea is that that's voluntary and there's no actual, this was, you know, he didn't violate any code of ethics for journalists. Okay, what else?
The only other thing I could think of was... Rule 404B in the Federal Rule of Evidence says you can't use evidence of other crimes wrongs as to prove like propensity to act a certain way. I'm sort of like parallel here where you're saying he lied and did a lot of immoral things, arguably, but you can't use that against him to prove he's going to be a certain way.
Right, and actually a couple of you talked about this rule. So say it again for those people who may not have had evidence yet.
Evidence of other crimes, wrongs, or acts is not admissible to the character of a person in order to show an action that conforms to the character.
Right, so it's this idea of, well, if it can't be admitted in a court of law, then why should we allow it to be considered by the character committee? Okay, what else?
That's like,
any other arguments that people can think of? Yeah.
I'm not sure. I know it's not a good argument, but you could argue that there's been a lapse of time and he's rehabilitated himself enough to say that he's not the character that he was.
Right. What's the lapse of time? Are we given it? I don't think we're given it. But so that's another argument. Certainly that if it was far enough in the past, that maybe there's some indication that, you know, he was a punk, you know, kid journalist. Now he's more mature. He's turned his life around or whatever. Yep.
I think a lot of times that's also viewed, and this is, I think, the Mustafa, with whether or not he was, like, really forthcoming. I don't know if this was, like, public knowledge when he got caught and when, you know, he eventually admitted it, but if he was forthcoming during the application process and, you know, tried to make amends because, I gather, enough time has passed and maybe...
Right, and actually, let me say that, and I can't emphasize that enough, that, I mean, I get constantly a stream of students who come into my office and say, oh my God, you know, I cheated on my, you know, senior high school paper, and I know it's in my record, and I'm convinced that that's going to keep me from being admitted to the bar. And the first thing I always say is, disclose it. Because if you disclose it, you've passed the first hurdle. Because the biggest red flag for them is if they find out about it and you didn't disclose it. So you're always better off
always better off saying, throwing it out there. Throw out your laundry list of concerns that are responsive to whatever the questions are. Obviously, you don't need to like tell them everything if it's not responsive to any question. But full candor is certainly important. And so if he was fully candid about it with the character committee, that would certainly be something that could weigh in favor of admission. Anything else? Okay. So, Brandon, what about your reaction to this?
Well, I start with my first argument, probably a little far-fetched, to be maybe that he lies so much in his articles that maybe there's a mental health problem there. Maybe he's like a compulsive liar, or I don't know. I know there has to be one of those.
Right, Jason Blair, right? Does everybody remember Jason Blair? And there was this whole notion of his complete like psychological breakdown because he was lying. About reporting all of his coverage and everything that we never actually met with any of these people, and he was just filtering it from other reporters on the web.
Yeah, so if the problem was that severe, I think that there could be a chance, but I don't think it's a slight chance, because would they have experts come in and analyze this?
Well, he may flag it himself. I mean, we don't know if he would necessarily, but you could certainly inquire, potentially about whether or not there was a mental health concern. Would that factor for or against him in your mind?
Against him.
Okay.
He wouldn't be competent to practice law.
So if he has a personality disorder and he's a compulsive liar, that certainly, in your mind, raises a serious red flag as far as his mental health. Okay.
That's those clients about all the time.
Right. Okay.
All right. And then based on his acts, I would say maybe his acts were, I know he didn't get charged with them, but they say in other cases that you don't have to be convicted as long as it's criminal in nature or it kind of sheds light on your honesty and integrity. And he wasn't charged with anything, but maybe he lied to his bosses. That's borderline perjury. It's not perjury in the court, but that's the nature of it. What he did with his fake websites and his fake notes, that's kind of fraud. That's criminal in nature, again, borderline, but they say those who constitute criminal in nature acts.
Okay.
Embezzlement and these other things like that. So I think, based on those, there's a chance that
he should be denied. Okay, so in your mind. Okay, any other ideas that people had in reaction to this? I mean, past, what's interesting, I had one student one year who said, what about malpractice insurance? We could force him to get malpractice insurance and have that be a requirement of his license. And the problem was, as another student accurately noted, that the malpractice insurance probably wouldn't cover potentially all, his misconduct if he was intentionally engaging in some kind of fraud or something like that. Another thing that was interesting that neither of you guys raised was the question of reputation and whether or not just by the press alone that would come with allowing him to be admitted to practice in that jurisdiction, whether that alone would create problems and just, bad will among the general public that we're allowing this guy to be a lawyer in practice. And, the response to that is, well, is that really what we want to be making our decisions about as a character and fitness committee? Which is, up for grabs as far as the question goes. You raised this issue about, too, this issue of timing, about whether or not, if a certain period of time has gone by, whether that would change our minds. What do we think? Should he ever be allowed to practice? What do you think, Michael? Should he ever be allowed or should he forever be banned from the practice of law?
I don't think his mistakes or his conduct was that grave. I mean, it goes pretty deep. It's not just like he lied. He went as far as to make, fake evidence to prove his lies. So it's kind of twisted, but if he can show after a amount of time, reformed, then isn't going to be like that. There's no reason why he shouldn't be.
Right. I mean, we'd probably want to have some pretty serious evidence of reform that he's engaged in on a very active level. Are there other kind of indicators that you would look for? Brandon, let's go back to you. Are there other kinds of indicators that you would look for to ensure that kind of reform? Or you mentioned the mental health piece, and maybe he can establish that he's been in therapy or, whatever.
Yeah, maybe, but what happened in the 90s? Right, the 90s, so in 2004? I still don't think he's going to get because I don't have time to do that. I gave it to 2014.
Why 2014?
2004, give them another 10 years, think about it. Get that 10.
So 10 years in your mind is a sufficient period of growth space for somebody to become a different person.
It's like going to jail. Okay.
I can get that. Okay. All right, good. All right, let's switch to our racist bar applicant on page 559. And Lindsay and Todd... Todd, I'm going to have you be arguing, also similarly, you guys are on the character committee, and Todd, you be arguing for admission, and Lindsay against admission. Where's Todd? Oh, there you are. So, what do you think? First of all, remind us again who Hale is. Todd.
Hale is a graduate of Southern Illinois University Law School. He passed the bar exam. He was a young racist in the community and found that was a world treasure for creator. Basically, these people within his church have been charged with all sorts of racial, holding more crimes against people of color and all sorts of things that far from being denied his position for being announced as racist.
So what's your best argument for why, in trying to persuade Lindsay, because it's really just the two of you on this committee, why you think he should be admitted?
I guess because it's, people are entitled to their personal beliefs, they're entitled to say how they feel about things that may not necessarily come into conflict with the practice of the law. This person will think whether or not their voice is them or covered by the street, first and second. Don't necessarily bark and pretend something. His personal views may not come into play with his professional life.
So Democrats can represent Republicans, people who have one viewpoint can represent another viewpoint. Has he given any indication that he would not take on certain kinds of cases?
No, I don't think he gave any evidence of that. It was just character committee felt it was.
There's no evidence that he would discriminate in the clients that he would accept.
That he's, I guess by his past views, it's on course to create issues.
Okay. Any other arguments in your mind? If he is a racist of the worst kind, is there any rule, any discipline rule that would allow us to discipline him in any way or disbar him if he was a practicing lawyer?
Well, it depends. I mean, if his, I guess if his racism is still stored open, but potentially walks in and is going to represent whoever comes to play, and it's not discriminating based on color of skin or religion. But again, it's his views that are maybe internal or maybe outside his professional life or absent through discrimination.
In your mind, is this any different from our female lawyer who wanted to be able to be a trial lawyer in a small town? Remember our topic? Okay, why is it different?
Because there, that woman, the issue was a matter of her, the firm, relatively representing the client. Here, there's no issue of a client involved, this is an issue of a personal part.
But we also don't have any evidence that he would do anything differently with clients.
Yeah,
other
there's
than.
No, there's no binding fiduciary duty to any client in this situation, whereas with her, there was. And the firm had a duty to represent that client, so
right.
So the firm has to make the best. This will be more position. The firm has to make the best decision possible for their client. They can't, that's unfortunate that she won't be on the case, but it's one case, and that was what was best for them.
So remember, the majority of you raised your hand and said,
gives us the heebie-jeebies, but really we're going to say that this is okay for the firm to make this determination and not put this trial lawyer up and basically deny her the experience of being able to try any cases in this small town. Yep?
I feel like Hale would take on a lot of cases that other attorneys wouldn't otherwise take on.
Uh-huh.
He might take on people who are bigots.
White supremacists?
Yeah.
Or
so, in a way, you know, even though he's probably a vile person, he still serves a good purpose in being in there.
Okay. All right. Any other arguments in favor of letting him in? Okay. Lindsay. Why do you want this schmuck to be kept out of the...
There are several reasons. First of all, the part of the tax suit we'll look into is his loyalty to the American government. And I think there's something to be questioned here about whether he's going to be able, with his belief system and the fact that he's such an advocate for white supremacists, to uphold the laws as they should be, particularly the Constitution. Like, the first thing that came to mind was the Equal Protection Clause. He had someone that said they were discriminating a person that was not a white supremacist, who said they've been discriminated against. Is he going to try and advocate for that person?
Are lawyers allowed to discriminate in the taking of their clients? Couldn't he just not take those clients?
Well, I don't think if he was assigned.
Let's say he's not going to do, so he's not taking any kind of appointments.
He decided your clients are. But I think the part of the question is still if you're going to be able to uphold the American government, if you would stand by that. And I think he's going to have problems with certain aspects of quality that our laws and our government stand for. Regardless of whether he's going to take those clients, I think if that's part of what the committee looks into, he's not going to be able to do that.
Is this any different from somebody who is anti-abortion and believes that Roe v. Wade should be overturned? Should we deny that person the ability to practice law because they are in disagreement with a Supreme Court decision that's still
that's
good law?
That's disagreement with the decision rather than disagreement with the government.
But it's the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Constitution.
There's an argument. You could make a non-frivolous claim for a change of the law, so I don't see that. I don't know. I don't think that's the same.
Wouldn't they also look to his actions, not necessarily in his practice of law, but in his personal life, that show whether or not he has the ability to practice law? So even if he, like, denies his clients, which he's allowed to do, if he's, like, killing people who are not white, then that's, or endorsing people to do the same thing, I think that speaks to his ability to practice.
Okay, so we have to dig a little bit deeper maybe into what his actions are in connection with his beliefs, yeah?
I mean, I was going to say something like that. He's publicly calling for violence against people, and that's not exactly the idea of the legal profession. It's not somebody that other lawyers want to associate themselves with. They call him their colleague.
Good point. Right, good point. Yeah.
I think that the act go to combating the First Amendment argument, saying this is just his beliefs. His beliefs have arguably gone beyond just beliefs in that he's advocating for a racial holy war, which at least one of his church members took upon himself to begin and actually murdered and hurt other people.
Right.
So I think there's a pretty good argument that it's not just beliefs anymore, that his personal life has gone into acts that can be considered criminal, whether he was an accomplice or some reason he could be criminally liable or
So you would have shown good judgment on the character committee because, as it turns out, he was later convicted of conspiracy to kill a federal judge and likely is going to spend the rest of his life in jail. Although I did read somewhere that he had gotten out of jail or something. I feel like somebody raised recently to me that he'd gotten out of jail or something. But anyway, regardless, good judgment nonetheless. Okay, so there were two questions that were raised. I just want to answer quickly. One was, and I'll answer these more in emails too, but one was with respect to Upjohn and NYSIG. There was a quick question about what's the impact of NYSIG on Upjohn, and I'll give you my 2 cents and then I'll send it out in an email too.
Upjohn, if you remember, involves the application of the attorney-client privilege to entities. Okay? And we talked about how this is an evidence rule to protect the confidentiality of communications. So the underlying facts aren't protected, but any kind of communications between the lawyer and any employees that are viewed as falling within the umbrella of the privilege under Upjohn are going to be protected. That said, okay, so that's an evidence rule, and that's an evidence case. Then you have NYSIG, which dealt with 4.2, which is the no contact rule. That involves the application of a discipline rule and whether or not you can contact employees at an entity. Okay, so the idea is at what point along the totem pole can you start contacting current employees of an entity just to be able to do fact investigation, to interview them and gather facts in support of your case. Different from actually getting at privileged communications. So you can ask them questions, you actually can't elicit privileged material, but you can certainly get statements and that kind of stuff. So it's all about protecting communications on the one hand versus getting at the underlying facts on the other. Okay, one's an evidence rule, one's a discipline rule. And what I talked about briefly was that Upjohn kind of laid out this wide blanket, but then it's constricted to a certain extent by the discipline rules, which allow you much broader contact just as far as getting factual information from current employees. And I can't remember what the other question was. I know it was from Will, and I can't remember what it was. So email me, and then we'll... And email me any other questions. Put them on TWN, whatever you want to do, and I will get out answers to you about anything that you have as far as questions. Okay? Good luck on the exam. I don't think it's hard. I've written it. You should be in good shape. And have a great winter holiday.
Are we going to bring
Yeah, totally open book. Bring whatever you want. Bring your kitchen sink for all I care. Yeah.
As soon as we were going to have
a practice. Oh, no, that's actually, we wanted to put a copy of the
trailer. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Wait,
I
didn't do that.
Oh, she
wouldn't.
Okay.
Oh,
thank you.